File 57.
If religious life in pre-war Germany had a disagreeable savour for the mouths of many people, this was because Christianity had been lowered to base uses by political parties that call themselves Christian, and because of the shameful way in which they tried to identify the Catholic faith with a political party. This substitution was fatal. It procured some worthless parliamentary mandates for the party in question, but the church suffered damage thereby. The consequences of that situation had to be borne by the whole nation, for the laxity that resulted in religious life set in at a juncture when everything was beginning to lose hold and vacillate, and the traditional foundations of custom and of morality were threatening to fall asunder. Yet all those cracks and clefts in the social organism might not have been dangerous if no grave burdens had been laid upon it. But they became disastrous when the internal solidarity of the nation was the most important factor in withstanding the storm of big events. In the political field also, observant eyes might have noticed certain anomalies of the Reich, which foretold disaster unless some alteration and correction took place in time. The lack of orientation in German policy, both domestic and foreign, was obvious to everyone who was not purposely blind. The best thing that could be said about the practice of making compromises is that it seemed outwardly to be in harmony with Bismarck's axiom that politics is the art of the possible. But Bismarck was a slightly different man from the chancellors who followed him. This difference allowed the former to apply that formula to the very essence of his polity, while in the mouths of the others it took on an utterly different significance. When he uttered that phrase, Bismarck meant to say that in order to attain a definite political end, all possible means should be employed, or at least that all possibilities should be tried. But his successors see in that phrase only a solemn declaration that one is not necessarily bound to have political principles or any definite political aims at all. And the political leaders of the Reich at that time had no far-seeing policy. Here again, the necessary foundation was lacking, namely a definite Weltanschauung, and these leaders also lacked that clear insight into the laws of political evolution, which is a necessary quality in political leadership. Many people who took a gloomy view of things at that time condemned the lack of ideas and lack of orientation which were evident in directing the policy of the Reich. They recognized the inner weaknesses and futility of this policy. But such people played only a secondary role in politics. Those who had the government of the country in their hands were quite as indifferent to principles of civil wisdom laid down by thinkers like Houston, Stuart, Chamberlain, as our political leaders now are. These people are too stupid to think for themselves, and they have too much self-conceit to take from others the instruction which they need. Oxenstierna gave expression to a truth which has lasted since time immemorial, when he said that the world is governed by only a particle of wisdom. Almost every civil servant of councillor rank might naturally be supposed to possess only an atom or so belonging to this particle. But since Germany became a republic, even this modicum is wanting. And that is why they had to promulgate the law for the defense of the republic, which prohibits the holding of such views or expressing them. It was fortunate for Oxenstierna that he lived at that time, and not in this wise republic of our time. Already before the war, that institution which should have represented the strength of the Reich, the Parliament, the Reichstag, was widely recognized as its weakest feature. Cowardliness and fear of shouldering responsibilities were associated together there in a perfect fashion. One of the silliest notions that one hears expressed today is that in Germany the parliamentary institution has ceased to function since the revolution. This might easily be taken to imply that the case was different before the revolution. But in reality, the parliamentary institution never functioned except to the detriment of the country. And it functioned thus in those days when people saw nothing or did not wish to see anything. The German downfall is to be attributed in no small degree to this institution. But that the catastrophe did not take place sooner is not to be credited to the Parliament, but rather to those who opposed the influence of this institution, which, during peace times, was digging the grave of the German nation and the German Reich. From the immense mass of devastating evils that were due either directly or indirectly to the Parliament, I shall select one of the most intimately typical of this institution, which was the most irresponsible of all time. The evil I speak of was seen in the appalling shilly-shally and weakness in conducting the internal and external affairs of the Reich. It was attributable in the first place to the action of the Reichstag, and was one of the principal causes of the political collapse. Everything subject to the influence of Parliament was done by halves, no matter from what aspect you may regard it. The foreign policy of the Reich in the matter of alliances was an example of shilly-shally. They wished to maintain peace, but in doing so they steered straight into war. Their Polish policy was also carried out by half measures. It resulted neither in a German triumph nor Polish conciliation, and it made enemies of the Russians. They tried to solve the Alsace-Lorraine question through half measures. Instead of crushing the head of the French Hydra once and for all with a mailed fist and granting Alsace-Lorraine equal rights with other German states, they did neither the one nor the other. Anyhow, it was impossible for them to do otherwise, for they had among their ranks the greatest traitors to the country, such as Herr Wetterle of the Centre Party. But still the country might have been able to bear with all this, provided the half-measure policy had not victimized that force in which, as the last resort, the existence of the empire depended, namely, the army. The crime committed by the so-called German Reichstag in this regard was sufficient of itself to draw down upon it the curses of the German nation for all time. On the most miserable of pretexts, these parliamentary party henchmen filched from the hands of the nation and threw away the weapons which were needed to maintain its existence, and therewith defend the liberty and independence of our people. If the graves on the plains of Flanders were to open today, the blood-stained accusers would arise, hundreds and thousands of our best German youth, who were driven into the arms of death by those conscienceless parliamentary ruffians who were either wrongly educated for their task, or only half-educated. Those youths, and other millions of the killed and mutilated, were lost to the fatherland simply and solely in order that a few hundred deceivers of the people might carry out their political maneuvers and their exactions, or even treasonably pursue their doctrinaire theories. By means of the Marxist and democratic press, the Jews spread the colossal falsehood about German militarism throughout the world and tried to inculpate Germany by every possible means, while at the same time the Marxist and democratic parties refused to assent to the measures that were necessary for the adequate training of our national defense forces. The appalling crime thus committed by these people ought to have been obvious to everybody who foresaw that in case of war, the whole nation would have to be called to arms, and that because of the mean huckstering of these noble representatives of the people, as they call themselves, millions of Germans would have to face the enemy ill-equipped and insufficiently trained. But even apart from the consequences of the crude and brutal lack of conscience which these parliamentarian rascals displayed, it was quite clear that the lack of properly trained soldiers at the beginning of a war would most probably lead to the loss of such a war. And this probability was confirmed in a most terrible way during the course of the World War. Therefore, the German people lost the struggle for the freedom and independence of their country because of the half-hearted and defective policy employed during times of peace in the organization and training of the defensive strengths of the nation. The number of recruits trained for the land forces was too small. But the same half-heartedness was shown in regard to the Navy, and made this weapon of national self-preservation more or less ineffective. Unfortunately, even the naval authorities themselves were contaminated with this spirit of half-heartedness, the tendency to build the ship on the stocks somewhat smaller than that just launched by the British, did not show much foresight, and less genius. A fleet which cannot be brought to the same numerical strength as that of the probable enemy ought to compensate for this inferiority by the superior fighting power of the individual ship. It is the weight of the fighting power that counts, and not any sort of traditional quality. As a matter of fact, modern technical development is so advanced and so well proportioned among the various civilized states, that it must be looked on as practically impossible for one power to build vessels which would have a superior fighting quality to that of the vessels of equal size built by the other powers. But it is even less feasible to build vessels of smaller displacement, which will be superior in action to those of larger displacement. As a matter of fact, the smaller proportions of the German vessels could be maintained only at the expense of speed and armament. The phrase used to justify this policy was in itself an evidence of the lack of logical thinking on the part of the naval authorities who were in charge of these matters in times of peace. They declared that the German guns were definitely superior to the British 30.5 centimeter as regards striking efficiency. But that was just why they should have adopted the policy of building 30.5 centimeter guns also, for it ought to have been their object not to achieve equality, but superiority in fighting strength. If that were not so, then it would have been superfluous to equip the land forces with 42-centimeter mortars, for the German 21-centimeter mortar could be far superior to any high-angled guns which the French possessed at that time, and since the fortresses could probably have been taken by means of 30.5-centimeter mortars. The army authorities unfortunately failed to do so. If they refrain from assuring superior efficiency in the artillery, as in the velocity, this was because of the fundamentally false principle of risk which they adopted. The naval authorities, already in times of peace, renounced the principle of attack and thus had to follow a defensive policy from the very beginning of the war. But by this attitude, they renounced also the chance of final success, which can be achieved only by an offensive policy. A vessel with slower speed and weaker armament will be crippled and battered by an adversary that is faster and stronger and can frequently shoot from a favorable distance. A large number of cruisers have been through bitter experiences in this matter. How wrong were the ideas prevalent among the naval authorities in times of peace was proved during the war. They were compelled to modify the armament of the old vessels and to equip the new ones with better armament whenever there was a chance to do so. If the German vessels in the Battle of the Skagerrak had been of equal size, the same armament, and the same speed as the English, the British fleet would have gone down under the tempest of the German 38-centimeter shells, which hit their aims more accurately and were more effective. Japan had followed a different kind of naval policy. There, care was principally taken to create with every single new vessel a fighting force that would be superior to those of the eventual adversaries. But because of this policy, it was afterwards possible to use the fleet for the offensive. While the army authorities refused to adopt such fundamentally erroneous principles, the navy, which unfortunately had more representatives in Parliament, succumbed to the spirit that ruled there. The navy was not organized on a strong basis, and it was later used in an unsystematic and irresolute way. The immortal glory which the navy won, in spite of these drawbacks, must be entirely credited to the good work and the efficiency and incomparable heroism of officers and crews. If the former commanders-in-chief had been inspired with the same kind of genius, all the sacrifices would not have been in vain.